Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Jonathan Pennington on why a well-known Bible passage is about more than church discipline.
When people look upon us, they know that we're Christians by, how did Jesus say it? By our love, right? And I think that's the same thing Matthew's kind of casting a vision for, that when we live in relationships of reconciliation with each other, where we forgive each other, that's a sign to the world of what it actually means to be a Christian, and to just embrace that.
Jonathan Pennington, next. Conflicts between Christians and moral failings are but a couple of instances where church discipline may be exercised to hopefully bring about needed correction and restoration. The go-to passage seen as giving a concise process for church discipline is in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 18, verses 15 through 20. Seminary professor Dr. Jonathan Pennington believes that passage is about more than church discipline, and he's written about it for Christianity Today in his piece, Are We Missing the Point of Matthew 18? Dr. Pennington, tell us what prompted this piece. I know your specialty, or one of them, is Matthew's Gospel.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a joy for the last 25 years of my life to really dedicate most of my time and energy to being a student of Matthew and a teacher of what Matthew teaches. So it's a great joy to do so. And as a pastor, you know, I'm very involved in pastoral ministry and care very much about that as well. I think what motivated this piece is that as I continue to teach through Matthew regularly, multiple times a year in both church and academic environments, I've been able to discern some of the patterns and some of the structure that's going on in Matthew. And I do think that what we see is that it's easy for any of us to take any portion of the Bible out of context. We all do it accidentally all the time. Mm-hmm. I guess some people maybe do it intentionally too, but right. Most of us probably do it accidentally. And I think for me, what motivated this piece is just seeing Matthew in its context, seeing Matthew 18 in its context more clearly, and seeing that it's doing a little bit more than what we typically use these verses for.
Well, before we start to get into the kind of the nutshell, what is, for those that don't know, and some churches practice it, some don't, what is church discipline? And then how does the 18th chapter of Matthew's Gospel relate to that?
Yeah. So all throughout history, churches have varied in how much they exercise this, from like super strict and like very intense mm-hmm. to not even part of their vocabulary. And you know, churches today would be that in that spectrum as well. I'd say probably in the more conservative and maybe especially more reformed world in the last 25 years, there seems to me a little bit of a uptick of interest and practice of this, probably not always super well, but I'm sure sometimes well. And I think the idea behind church discipline is that the church needs to pursue a kind of purity within its ranks for the sake of the testimony of the gospel. And so the emphasis that is usually made is that it's really important that we have a clear membership, who's a member and who's not, and then that membership is held accountable. And you know, of course, this goes back. I mean, the Puritans mm-hmm. probably was the most obvious, strong, straight connection to those churches that would practice it today is probably they were getting a lot of that inspiration from Puritans. So church discipline is the idea that when someone is involved in a kind of gross or obvious public sin, that there are steps that you go through to kind of address it. And that ultimately, if someone refuses to listen to the wisdom of the church leadership and the church decides that this actually is a gross sin that is not in keeping with the character of Christ, that the final step of that is actually to remove them from membership and to remove them from being welcome in the fellowship for the sake of the purity of the witness of the gospel. So that's the idea behind church discipline.
And that final step, some refer to it as excommunication, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And
right,
so, but obviously restoration correction. It's all kind of part of bound up in all of that.
Hopefully, hopefully that should be the goal for sure. Yeah.
But are you saying that Matthew 18 and this particular passage, people can look it up, but verses 15 through 20, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his sin just between the two of you, then you bring two witnesses, and then you, if he or she won't still hear them, then you tell it to the church, and then if they won't hear the church, then you treat them, depending upon the version, right, as a pagan or an unbeliever or something right. to that effect. Are you saying it doesn't apply to church discipline, or you're saying that's too narrow of a view?
Yeah, good question. The latter, for sure. I mean, I do think that, as I say in the little essay I wrote, I think, you know, there's good guidance here for people, for church leaders, that when they come to a point that they decide they, if that's what their conviction is, that they want to exercise church discipline and they go about doing it. I think Matthew 18 is really helpful because it does lay out a pattern that I think is honoring to the situation and is wise. Reconciliation. I think that is something I'd really want to emphasize, that when people use this for church discipline, to keep that goal in mind. It's not punished. It's not to shame. It's to hopefully bring about restoration through a clarity of what's right and what's wrong. So yeah, I think it's probably the best passage if a church is going to practice church discipline. I think it's the most important passage for that. But I do think there's something a lot bigger and more beautiful and more important going on than just using those Matthew 18, 15 to 20 for that purpose.
One thing that's interesting, Dr. Pennington, in your piece, you stress that chapter 18, which we're talking about in Matthew's gospel, which has this passage, which has been typically applied to church discipline, is but just one part of Matthew's gospel. And we always think of, don't take a verse out of context. And in one sense, maybe you're saying we're taking a passage or even a chapter maybe out of context. Talk to us a little bit about that, about the context of Matthew 18 in the middle of all of those other chapters of Matthew.
Yeah, that's something I care a lot about. I think we all should care about that, but it is something that is particularly important to me. I am literally the son of an English professor, so I do care about literary structure, but it's something that has really opened up the Gospel of Matthew and helped me understand it more, is to pay attention to how the whole book is structured. And I'm not alone in this. This is something that Matthean scholars have long appreciated, particularly that Matthew has these five big teaching blocks, these discourses we call them, that each give very important instructions from Jesus on some aspect of what it means to be a disciple. And those five big teaching blocks, the most famous one we all know is the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 to 7, but that's actually only one of five. The other ones are chapters 10, chapters 13, chapter 18, and then chapters 23 to 25. And so one of the points I'm making in this essay that you're picking up on is that we need to recognize, you know, these verses in Matthew 18, not only aren't, you know, we need to look at all of Matthew 18 together, but that Matthew 18 is part of this five-block system to cast this vision for what it means to be a disciple. And then we have to ask, okay, so what's Matthew 18 about? Like, what's its particular contribution to this vision?
Can you touch briefly on those five blocks, those five major blocks of instruction? Do they have a particular theme that applies to discipleship?
I think they do, and this is part of a larger argument some of your hearers may be interested in, that I have made in a book called Jesus the Great Philosopher, and also in another book called The Sermon on the Mount and Human Flourishing that I wrote, which is that these five major teaching blocks would have been very easily understood in the ancient world as what was called an epitome, or even an enchiridion, two fancy words that just basically mean a collection of teachings around a theme. That each of them are a particular thematic block of teaching, so that a disciple of the master, sage, philosopher, teacher, whatever word you want to use, can memorize and learn what it means to follow this way of being in the world, and with him as the model and him as the teacher. So the five major teaching blocks, again, do have a theme. I think the Sermon on the Mount, 5 to 7, has primarily of what it means to do the will of God. It means to be righteous according to Jesus. Chapter 10 is about what it means to be a witness in the world, especially a hostile world. Chapter 13, which is really the middle of the book of Matthew in many ways, is about the mysterious ways that the kingdom of heaven comes into the world and functions. It's all about the mystery of the kingdom of heaven. Chapter 18, which is what we're talking about here, is about what life together looks like in the community, particularly what we should value. And then chapters 23 to 25 are about judgment, both now and especially in the future, the famous kind of end times, you know, chapters there. So each of those are not all that Jesus teaches, even in Matthew. They're not all that the New Testament teaches about what it means to be a disciple, but those are five really important collections of thematic teachings. And again, what's relevant for our discussion here is that chapter 18 is not actually primarily about disciplining people. It's part of this larger question of how do Christian disciples live together in God's kingdom? And the answer to that is primarily that they live together in relationships of love, in relationships of, particularly the way Matthew describes it, of mercy, which is where you care for those in need and you forgive those who have wronged you. And that's this sort of key idea in all of the Gospel of Matthew. I think it's the key idea of Jesus's moral teaching, is that a disciple is one who is merciful. That's what he himself models. And then he tells us to do the same. And to be merciful means that, again, you help those who are in need, whether they deserve that help or not. You show compassion on them and you help them. And on the other side of mercy is you forgive those who have wronged you. And I think if you read through Matthew with that, with those ideas in mind, you'll see that it's a really beautiful and powerful theme throughout, but it really gets this particular emphasis in chapter 18, as we're called to live together in relationships of mercy toward each other.
Well, my guest today on His People is Dr. Jonathan Pennington, and we're talking about his Christianity Today piece, Are We Missing the Point of Matthew 18? It's about more than church discipline. It's about flourishing community. And he is a professor of New Testament at Southern Seminary, and also he is a pastor of spiritual formation at Sojourn East Church in Louisville. So this passage, and these are verses 15 through 20 in Matthew 18, and just as you've said, Dr. Pennington, that we can tend to take Matthew chapter 18 sort of out of context of the rest of Matthew, and you've put it in context for us, and I appreciate that. So we can also take those verses, verses that are typically applied only to church discipline, verses 15 through 20 in Matthew 18, take them out of context of the 18th chapter of Matthew. Can you put them in context of the 18th chapter of Matthew for us and what the rest of the chapter looks like, how it bears on that passage?
Yeah, so there are several themes or kind of sub-themes within this idea of life together as Christ's disciples in his coming kingdom. And if you read through Matthew 18, you'll see that there's a lot of emphasis on taking care of those who are vulnerable, the emphasis on little ones and not causing them to stumble. It's intentionally, I think, a little vague metaphorically, in the sense that I think it's meant to be applied to a lot of situations. But because the point is that Jesus has shown is really valuing those, having compassion on those who are not in power and having compassion on those who are in need, whether it's orphans or widows or the unborn, or, you know, you can name it, any people or person that is in any way persecuted or neglected or prejudiced against in some way. It's really meant to challenge our tendency to overlook those people ourselves. So I think that's one of the big themes there in chapter 18. But then I think the biggest one that touches on 18 verses 15 to 20 is, of course, forgiving others who have wronged you. And a big part of what I was trying to say in that essay is that the verses that we go to, chapter 18, 15 to 20, are followed up by a really powerful parable, a really haunting parable, I often describe it as. That is the parable of the unforgiving servant, where Jesus tells a parable that strikes us all profoundly in our hearts. We are forgiven greatly by God, and yet we really struggle to forgive others. And if you know the parable of the unforgiving servant, I'm sure you do, is that, you know, you really feel the contrast that this man is forgiven this really
massive,
infinite amount.
Yeah.
Yeah. A massive, almost unpayable amount. And then he turns around and is unwilling to forgive a small amount. And I mean, this is one of the parables of Jesus. Like, you don't even have to think about what the application is, obviously. And he tells us what the application is. So too, if you will not forgive others, but there's, I mean, you're already feeling the conviction of it just to read it, you know? And I think it's so important to recognize that that's the illustration that he uses to explain what he means by verses 15 to 20, that again are, you know, you can use them as steps towards what to do in church discipline. But I think the point, if you read it in context, is God wants us to live in relationships of reconciliation with each other. And if we're unwilling to do that, that's a sign that we, maybe not even a follower of Christ, it's at least a sign that we are missing God's way if we're unwilling to forgive others. And so the point of chapter 18, 15 to 20 again is to really exhort us to be very intentional about living in relationships that reconcile with each other. And sometimes we need to bring other people in to help. We, you know, if we have a conflict and obviously two people see it very differently, or there wouldn't be a conflict. What I think Jesus is saying is here, you know, when it's appropriate, bring some wise church leaders into that conflict and work together to hear each other and to seek being reconciled so that you can actually forgive each other. And if you have one party who's completely unwilling to be engaged in that process, then maybe that person is the problem, mm-hmm. you know? Now it's complex, you know, because there are realities of trauma and that we need to be sensitive to. And there's also a reality that just some people haven't begun doing their deeper inner work yet. And so sometimes people can't, you know, they just don't have the equipment yet to sort of work on reconciliation. We have to be careful. This is why I want to be so careful with this passage, that we don't just go to it to kind of send people out of the church. You know, it's complex, but the vision is that we be people who live in relationships of forgiveness towards each other. And I think that's how that parable sort of unpacks and helps us see verses 15 to 20 better. I know it's kind of a long answer, sorry, but hopefully that's helpful. Well,
and this is probably obvious, but that first verse, I think, of Matthew 18, 15 through 20, it talks about if we are sinned against, to then go to the person that sinned against us. It in other words, it's showing what you were just describing, that relationship, not go and tell someone else or gossip about it with other people, but to actually go to the person that you believe has wronged you, or as the scripture says, sinned against you.
Yeah, because to be a disciple is to live in relationship with other Christians well. You know, I think this has been a very obvious problem with especially modern Western Christianity, is a lot of people have discerned or observed that, you know, we tend to be very individualistic, and you know, there are pros and cons to that, but the con is that we really often think of our Christian faith as just my relationship with God personally, and then the relationships with others are secondary or tertiary in their importance. But I think when you read the New Testament, it to be a Christian is to be brought into a set of relationships that are different, that you have a family that is different. You now call other Christians of every race and gender and ethnicity and educational background and denomination, call them brother and sister. And that is so, we're so used to that language, we've kind of lost the weight of what that's saying, is that that's our primary identity now. Our primary family is other Christians. I'm not just an individual who's saved by faith. I'm actually a person who's been welcomed into a different community of people. And so, because that's who I am, I'm part of a different family, I have got to value and work at one of the hardest things, and that is forgiving people when they've wronged me and asking forgiveness when I've wronged them. And so that's why I think this chapter is so important. And that's why it grieves me when it gets kind of just co-opted to only be about this kind of these steps of what to do in a bad situation. It's fine to use it for that, but you're missing the beauty of the vision that this is inviting us into, a life together of a flourishing community.
And in this piece, you make reference to a household code. In the household of faith. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So it's this comes from ancient Greek philosophy, and you see it in the New Testament several times as well. And that is that to adopt a certain philosophy or a religion means that you adopt a sort of way of seeing and being in the world. And that includes, as I was just saying, thinking carefully about what the relationships that you're coming into look like. And so if you think about Paul's letters, he often talks about what the relationship of men and women is to each other, what the relationship of husbands and wives is to each other, what the relationship of parents and children is to each other, what the relationship of servants or slaves, right, whatever you want to translate that, to those who are in power. And so those are called household codes. Those are like a set of instructions to make sure that you treat other people, especially if you have a power differential over them, that you treat them with love and kindness and respect rather than, you know, oppressing them or ignoring them or thinking you're better than them or something. And so, yeah, those are well recognized in Paul's letters. And my point is that if you look at not just Matthew 18, but it's really Matthew 18, 19, and 20 is really a pretty comprehensive household code for life together in Christ's kingdom. Like, again, valuing those who are vulnerable, living in relationships of reconciliation. If you read on in chapters 19 and 20, you get issues of money, how you should think about money. You get issues of marriage and remarriage. You get issues of just what it means to be a disciple along all those lines. So yeah, that's the idea of the household code.
In chapters 18 through 20, you said it in the context of all of Matthew, but as you were just explaining, but it shows the unavoidable reality of conflict within the Christian community, and that Jesus is explaining that it shouldn't surprise us, that conflict is part of normal Christian life, normal Christian community.
Yeah, no, I know. And what I'm laughing about is that, you know, I wrote this article, I don't know, you know, a few months ago or whatever, and a little delay before it comes out or whatever, right?
Right.
And like, literally the week it came out, I was, you know, I'm very involved in church life, and I was involved in a very intense conflict between some people in church, and including me. And I just had to laugh, you know, because I write this essay, you know, about you shouldn't be surprised at the conflict. And I'm like, wait a minute, what is happening in my life? I'm in this. And I always think that God has this huge loving file cabinet called watch this funny ironies, you know, that he's doing out of love for us, that he's like, you know, okay, here's, you know, you're teaching and understanding the truth and helping others do it. You pastor, let's make sure that you can walk in these ways too. And, imperfectly, certainly, but I'm thankful for that actually, because my own essay was like haunting me as I was entering into this conflict thinking, okay, I want to be a real person. I don't want to teach others that this is the way to be and then be a jerk in my own conflict. And so I'm thankful. And maybe I'm just such a weak person that God has to make me like write articles about it so that I can't escape it, you know? So, it's just funny how God does that. And I trust him in that very much. So,
right. Part of our sanctification. And little would we know that we're thinking we're helping someone else, and at the same time,
exactly,
he's using it in our lives as well.
Totally, very thankful.
And so, speaking of pastors, I mean, obviously, this piece that you wrote, are we missing the point of Matthew 18? It's about more than church discipline. Of course, that's for all believers who are part of local churches, and yet at the same time, specifically for the pastor, and of course, church conflict, as you were just explaining, and you hear it frequently, if you ask a pastor, what is the most difficult part of what you do? Almost always they'll say the conflict between believers. So, but this kind of reminds them that Jesus has said to expect this. Here's sort of the way to deal with it.
And I think that was my main point in the essay. My main point in the essay was not to like criticize people who use this as a church discipline passage. Like I said, I mean, that's, I think it's a fine way to use it, but to really instead encourage us all that the normal Christian life involves a lot of conflict because we are complex, sinful social creatures, and to kind of normalize the expectation of that and normalize the emotion of that. And then from that place, then to be able to say, okay, so what does God want for us? What is the way that actually, what is Christ's way that's going to actually bring us life and bring other people lives, bring other people life? And that is to not be surprised and to step towards the hard work of being forgiving and seeking relationships of reconciliation.
And this is probably outside of the scope of this, Dr. Pennington, but of course you're talking within the Christian community, within the church, but certainly it applies, obviously, to the world in general, to expect conflict, maybe in the workplace or in our family, or not that we want it or we encourage it, but when it comes, it shouldn't be a shock.
That's absolutely right. And of course, Jesus talks about that in Matthew a lot, back in chapter 10, for example. That's the point of the kind of parallel discourse or teaching of chapter 10, which is that as you live as Christians in the world, the normal expectation should be opposition. And you know, that's really hard for us in modern United States, I think, especially because we've had a good run, you know, and there's some really positive influence of Christianity, I think, on our culture. And we have freedoms and success and finances, unlike Christians, probably in any other part of the world forever throughout all of history.
Right.
And so I think it's really hard for us as Christians to really kind of believe that, that we should expect conflict because we've been in power and we've been in influence. But I think it's a great time for the church to sort of re-embrace that, which is what most Christians' experience have been throughout the world is like, why are you surprised that people don't like us? And why are you surprised that maybe we're losing some influence? I mean, that's actually the normal Christian's experience throughout history. And it's so important that we don't like then take on this mantle of being a jerk about it as if somehow that's like noble or something. Instead, what I'm suggesting is that we should be humble and recognize that if we're opposed, first of all, we hope that's not because we're being mean-spirited. Right. Hopefully it's because we're being faithful, not mean-spirited. But if we're opposed, we should relax in the sense of like, okay, that's the normal Christian life. Like, why do we have to be in power? Why do we have to be the winners? Why do we have to be the influencers? Why not be humble, build beautiful things, be a community of peace and a community of love, that when people look upon us, they know that we're Christians by, how did Jesus say it? By our love, right? And I think that's the same thing Matthew's kind of casting a vision for, that when we live in relationships of reconciliation with each other, where we forgive each other, that's a sign to the world of what it actually means to be a Christian, and to just embrace that.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Jonathan Pennington, professor at Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and author of the piece, Are We Missing the Point of Matthew 18? You can read it at ChristianityToday.com. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Juan Sanchez on people God used in his journey to following Christ.
You know, here is the beauty and the glory of Jesus expressed in inconveniencing love. Self-inconveniencing love of his people, which as a kid coming from Puerto Rico was the very thing I was longing for. And I found it not by being accepted by the culture or being like the culture, but I found that in Christ, and Christ loved me through his people.
That's tomorrow at this same time, right here on His People. Thanks for listening.